Ambry presents Next and Now, a podcast on all things genetic.
Welcome, everyone, to our webinar this morning. This is a one-hour webinar entitled The Clinical and Management Implications of Diagnostic Exome Sequencing, A Deeper Look at the Scientific Evidence. In this hour, we will explore the post-diagnostic implications of whole exome sequencing as it pertains to clinical practice with some eye-opening data that two co-authors of their own work will be presenting live today. With us here today is our first speaker, Julie Cohen. She is a board-certified genetic counselor at the Kennedy Krieger Institute in Baltimore, Maryland, and she works in the Department of Neurology and Developmental Medicine in the Division of Neurogenetics. She sees patients in the neurogenetics, developmental pediatrics, leukodystrophy, and muscle disorder clinics. And she has an avid research interest, including clinical applications of new genomic technologies and psychosocial aspects of living with genetic conditions. Our second speaker is Dr. Alejandro Iglesias, who is an assistant professor of pediatrics and director of the Inherited Metabolic Program, program director of the Medical Genetics Residency Program, and attending physician in the Division of Medical Genetics. He has been a pediatrician and a geneticist for the last 25 years and trained in pediatrics and genetics in Argentina before moving to the United States. We are really thrilled to have you both here with us today. This is an approved CEU event, so please complete the post-webinar survey, which will automatically appear when you log off the WebEx system. Thank you so much for your time, Julie. Feel free to begin.
All right. Hello, everyone. Good morning, good afternoon, depending on where you're located. Before I begin, just to say for that neither myself nor Dr. Iglesias have any conflicts of interest to disclose. Stephanie, thank you for the introduction. As you said, I'm a genetic counselor at the Kennedy Krieger Institute, and I'm going to be presenting data from a paper that my colleagues and I wrote describing our experience with clinical exome sequencing, and today be focusing on the clinical utility of those results. So before I dive into our results, I just want to remind ourselves of the big picture. Why does it even matter, the etiologic diagnosis? It's more than just academic curiosity, and there also is a misconception that the only reason to do genetic testing is for reproductive reasons or recurrence risk if the parents want to have more children. But of course, there's many more benefits to understanding the etiologic diagnosis. If we know the underlying cause, we can often provide more information about prognosis and what to expect in the future, whether the condition is going to be stable or get worse, and other things to look out for. Knowing the diagnosis can affect a person's medical management in terms of screening for other system involvement or screening for future complications. Sometimes there are specific treatments that we would administer based on the genetic diagnosis. And lastly, of course, there are a number of psychosocial benefits to patients and their families understanding the underlying cause. We know that a substantial portion of patients with developmental disabilities have an underlying genetic cause for their condition, and our ability to diagnose those genetic conditions has come a long way, beginning with our ability just to look at a single variant or a single gene, and then in recent years being able to look at multiple genes at once. And now today, and for the past few years, we've had the ability to look at virtually all of our genes at once. So just to remind ourselves, what is the exome and what is the genome? So we know that a gene, of course, is a stretch of DNA, and the parts of our DNA that code for protein, those are called the exons, and in between each exon is a non-coding sequence called the intron, and then in between each gene is a long section of non-coding DNA. The exons collectively we call the exome, and the exome makes up about 1%, 1 to 2% of the entire genome. So shown here we have the big apple, that's the genome, which is 3 billion DNA letters, and the exome is that 1 to 2% of those 20,000 genes that code for protein. So why do we look at the exome? The reason why we focus on the exome with this testing is because even though the exons make up a small portion of our total DNA, the majority, about 85% of mutations that lead to inherited disease are located in the exons. So an analogy I use with my patients is that it's sort of like focusing on the part of this giant haystack where your needle is most likely to be. Now, granted, there's still a lot of hay you have to sort through, and it is certainly possible that your needle is located somewhere else, but we do have a higher chance of finding it by looking in the exome. So a detailed description of the exome sequencing of the technical aspects is beyond the scope of this presentation, and instead I will refer you to this excellent review article by Les Biesecker and Robert Green put out earlier this year in the New England Journal. But just as a very brief overview, how exome sequencing works is that first the DNA is fragmented, and then our regions of interest, the exons, are captured, they undergo replication and amplification, and then this is sequenced. The sequences are then aligned with the reference genome, and the variants are called, variants meaning differences compared to what the reference genome is. And then these variants are filtered and then eventually undergo interpretation. Now, those last two points I said very quickly, but they're actually quite complicated. So this is one of my favorite genetics cartoons. As you can see here, they have uncovered this puzzle of 3 billion pieces, and now phase two is an interpretation, and this guy over here thinks he found a corner piece. So how do we sort through all of this variation? Because we know that every person has many thousands of differences in our DNA, most of which don't cause any problems. So a challenge is interpreting and identifying the one or few variants responsible for a patient's phenotype. Each laboratory takes a different approach to this, and they have different pipelines, but overall, these variants are filtered based on the allele frequency, inheritance and disease mechanism, and phenotype-defined genes. Now, an important step in this filtering is comparing to parents, and many labs will perform trio exome sequencing, meaning they'll sequence the child and then both parents, and that helps identify de novo variants and also allows you to determine the phase of two variants, for example, in a recessive gene. So through this filtering process, many of the variants are filtered out, and you're left with a shorter list that undergoes manual review by the laboratory geneticists and genetic counselors. And this shorter list is reviewed, taking into account a number of aspects, such as evolutionary conservation, in silico prediction, looking at databases of variants in normal and control populations. And after all of this process, the laboratory comes up with a consensus review, and then they issue a clinical report to the ordering provider. And then the provider, then our job is to look at what the lab has reported and review the evidence for ourselves and make the final determination as to whether we think the variants are explaining or contributing to our patient's phenotype. So there's different ways we can think about variant classification and interpretation. Again, a detailed discussion of this is beyond the scope, but just to mention briefly that you could classify a particular variant based on the pathogenicity, so is it messing up the gene or not? And the ACMG has laid out different categories of pathogenicity, going from mutation all the way down to a benign variant. And then you would interpret these variants based on the clinical relevance. So you could have a definite mutation in a gene that has nothing to do with your patient's phenotype. So when we interpret the clinical relevance, we think about the association with the disease and the overlap with the phenotype under investigation. So very, in a nutshell, that's how exome sequencing works. It's, of course, more complicated than that. So what are the advantages and disadvantages of exome sequencing? So exome sequencing is an efficient and cost-effective approach compared to sequential gene testing. While exome sequencing does cost several thousand dollars, if you look at the prices for looking at one or just a handful of genes, it quickly outweighs that. So another advantage is that it's an unbiased genotype-first approach to diagnosis, and this is going to allow you to identify patients with atypical presentations of disease, identify patients earlier in the disease course, and identify multiple genetic disorders in a single patient. Now, on the other hand, there are a number of disadvantages to exome sequencing. We call it the whole exome, but it's not really the whole exome. There are regions and genes or parts of genes that are missed, and there are parts of genes that are not covered well. There's also some mutation types that we can't see by exome sequencing. Exome sequencing is good at picking up changes in one or a few DNA letters, but we can't see chromosomal changes or trinucleotide repeat disorders such as Fragile X syndrome. And also there's limitations in our knowledge of gene function and association with disease. A lot of our genes, they may have a name, but we don't know what they do, and they haven't been linked to disease before in humans. So despite these disadvantages, a major advantage of exome sequencing is the high diagnostic yield. And a number of studies have demonstrated this yield. So the studies that have looked at the heterogeneous lab-based cohort. So from the commercial laboratories have published their findings, and they report a diagnostic yield on the order of 25 to 30%. And then exome sequencing in specific populations, such as intellectual disability or ataxia, these studies have shown even higher yields, some greater than 50%. So I think we can all agree that there's a high diagnostic yield for exome sequencing. But what we need more evidence on is the clinical utility. So what do we do with those results? And what my colleagues and I set out to do was to explore what is the clinical utility of exome sequencing results. So my colleagues and I recently published this paper in the Annals of Neurology. We performed a retrospective analysis of our first 78 completed cases at our institute, Kennedy Krieger Institute, beginning in November 2011 through February 2014. And the patients seen in our neurogenetics and metabolism clinic, these are patients with pediatric onset neurodevelopmental disabilities, including developmental delay, intellectual disability, autism, cerebral palsy, seizures, abnormal brain MRIs. Most of our patients had at least some prior testing. All patients underwent an evaluation by a geneticist or neurologist together with genetic counseling. And when it was determined that exome sequencing was appropriate test, we sent it and it was performed at one of several commercial labs. So what was our diagnostic yield? So out of those first 78 completed cases, 32 patients or 41% of our cohort had a presumptive diagnosis, meaning that it was identified a pathogenic or likely pathogenic variant in a gene that matches a patient phenotype. For 14 of our patients, or 18% of the cohort, the result was completely negative, meaning the lab didn't report any variants that they thought could be related. And then for 41%, the lab reported something other than a positive result. So that's what I have listed here as a variant, meaning something that's not definitely known was their diagnosis. So that sounds like a high percentage of variants, 41%. But keep in mind that the lab issues what they think, anything that could be related to the patient's phenotype, and then it's the clinician's job to make the final determination. And when we looked at those variants reported by the lab, about half the time we felt we were able to rule them out as related to our patient's phenotype. For example, based on what we knew about the patient's phenotype, that it didn't match the disorder, or based on further testing like an enzyme analysis. So that left 18% of our cohort with what we considered a variant of unknown significance, meaning we're really not sure is this related to the patient's condition. For three of our patients, it was a likely positive diagnosis, meaning they had an alteration in a clinically novel gene, and there was substantial evidence that it could be related to their condition, but not enough to be definitive. So again, overall, we have a 41% diagnosis rate. Now, something interesting to point out is that for 44% of our positives, individual testing for the gene was not available at the time exome sequencing was ordered. So in other words, exome sequencing was the only way we could have made that diagnosis. Also, to give you some updates, since we published that, one of our negative cases became positive upon reanalysis. We had the lab take another look at their data, and this child was found to have a disease-causing mutation in a gene that just hadn't been discovered at the time. And then one of our novel genes was reclassified as a definite positive based on the identification of additional cases. So if you add those in, we have a diagnostic yield of 34 out of 78, which is 43%. And to date, we've completed over 200 patients, and the diagnostic rate has held fairly constant. So that's our yield in agreement with previous studies that, all right, this is a good test. We can diagnose a lot of patients. But what does it even matter? Who cares? So we went back and looked, what were the management changes on the basis of these diagnoses? So out of our positives, out of those 32, we found that all of the patients had their management changed in at least one way. For many of our patients, it did have an impact on reproductive decision-making or reproductive counseling. So for disorders that were determined to be inherited, for example, a recessive disorder, this enabled the parents to use the information for PGD or prenatal diagnosis. Many of our cases turned out to be de novo, which would be associated with a low recurrence risk, and the families then felt comfortable moving forward with more children. And then even if the parents weren't having more children, this information was relevant for their siblings. Another management change we felt was that in 7 of our patients, or 22%, the result changed the presumed inheritance pattern. So some examples here would be a brother and a sister pair who were presumed to have a recessive disorder actually had a dominant disease that recurred due to germline mosaicism. In another child, he was found to have two completely different diseases, one recessive and one de novo dominant, And then we also had a child who was homozygous for a recessive mutation due to UPD. So those were some surprises, and those had an impact on genetic counseling for the patient and their family. Now, one could make an argument that those first two categories really aren't changing the medical management. Even so, we found that for 59% of our patients, that their management was changed in one of these other ways that really did affect their medical management. So for 31%, the prognosis was altered. For almost 20%, we investigated involvement of other symptoms. For 16%, we looked at monitored for future complications. For 16%, we discontinued a medication. For 6%, we started a medication. And for 9%, the diagnoses that were established had active clinical therapeutic trials. So now I'm going to go through a few cases that illustrate these management changes. So this first case is a 10-year-old boy who presented around age 1 or 2 with developmental delay. So actually his milestones were normal at first, but then he developed gait difficulties between age 1 and 3 years. He became ataxic. He had low motor tone, muscle tone, and had learning disabilities. MRIs showed cerebellar atrophy as seen here in the back of his brain. We can see that cerebellum is quite small. This child had an extensive workup, including a SNP array, an ataxia panel, some single gene testing, and a metabolic screening, and that all came back normal. So we, after discussion with the family, we ordered exome sequencing. And the result from exome sequencing for this child was compound heterozygous mutations in a gene called ADCK3. This causes a recessive disease, primary coenzyme Q10 deficiency, which is a form of mitochondrial disease. Clinically, it fit very well with his phenotype and his course. And the management implication here is that this is actually a potentially treatable disorder with oral coenzyme Q10. So we started him on CoQ10, and we are hoping that this stabilizes his disease or leads to improvement. The next case is a 3-year-old girl with neonatal onset seizures. Her first documented seizure was on the first day of life, but in retrospect, actually, her mother thinks she was having seizures in the womb. Her mother reported several episodes of the fetus with shaking in the womb, that it really does sound like a seizure. So this little girl has severe dystonia of her extremities. Centrally, she is very hypotonic, but her extremities are very stiff. She's globally delayed. Her brain MRIs have been essentially normal. Due to her severe dystonia, her clinicians recommended an empiric treatment with levodopa or L-DOPA for her dystonia. And she initially did have a positive result, a positive response to L-DOPA, although it didn't improve with increasing dose. So this child actually had no prior workup due to financial limitations. This was an international family. They traveled here, saved all her money just to have this evaluation. And so she hadn't had other testing. And after careful consideration, we told the family that if they're going to pay for one genetic test, that it should be exome sequencing. And that's what they did. And it turned out to be a pretty good decision because exome sequencing identified a de novo mutation in KCNQ2, which encodes a potassium channel. And mutations in this gene are associated with early infantile epileptic encephalopathy. Her clinical presentation and course fits perfectly with what's been described for this condition. And the implication here is that we discontinued treatment with L-DOPA because there was no longer any rationale for that. She did not have a DOPA-responsive dystonia. So the third case I'm going to tell you about is a 3-year-old girl who presented, like many of the children we see in our clinic, with global developmental delay and hypotonia. She had microcephaly since birth, and on brain MRI, she had polymicrogyria. So you could see here, especially in the frontal part of her brain, the abnormal gyral pattern. So this little lady, her family history was non-contributory. She was the first child for her parents. They were non-consanguineous. She had an extensive workup with a SNP array. We ordered a number of single gene tests looking for polymicrogyria genes. She also had screening for metabolic diseases, and this all came back normal. So after discussion with the family, they really wanted to find the cause, especially because they wanted to have more children. So they went with exome sequencing, and the results returned showing a de novo alteration in a gene called DYNC1H1. This was a novel change. It hadn't been reported before, but it affected amino acid that was completely conserved across evolution, and the in silico tools predicted that it was deleterious. So at the time this result was issued, this gene was not very well known. The year before it had been published, mutations in this gene were reported in two patients with severe intellectual disability and neuronal migration defects. This is shown here from the paper that I referenced. So we, given that this was also a de novo mutation in our child and she had a similar phenotype, we thought that this made sense. At the time, again, there was not a lot of information known about it. So in addition to those two patients with neuronal migration defects and intellectual disability, mutations in this gene had been reported in five other families, four with Charcot-Marie-Tooth disease and one with spinal muscular atrophy. The mutations were spread out all across the gene. So on the basis of this diagnosis, so we felt this was consistent with a diagnosis of intellectual disability with neuronal migration defects. And now we know a lot more about this gene and a number of other cases have been reported. It's been assigned an OMIM number. And actually our patient-specific mutation has been reported in several other patients now. So the implications for this diagnosis, the first is that it prompted us to investigate systemic involvement. Given that mutations in this gene had also been reported in patients with SMA and Charcot-Marie-Tooth, we recommended an EMG and nerve conduction study. And this actually was abnormal. The nerve conduction study showed chronic denervation similar to what is seen in patients with mild spinal muscular atrophy. This finding altered her prognosis because we advised the family that based on the nerve conduction finding, she may have progressive motor difficulties in the future. We can't say that for sure, of course, but this was important because typically when we have a brain malformation like polymicrogyria, we usually think this is a fairly stable condition, but in her case, she might have difficulties in the future. Another big implication for this family was for reproductive planning. The recurrence risk was low due to the de novo mutation, and so the parents felt comfortable moving ahead with another pregnancy, and last summer they gave birth to a healthy baby girl. This last case I'm going to tell you about, I think, is maybe one of our most compelling. This family will always stick with me. So the child shown here, she's here sleeping on her in her mother's lap. So she is a four-year-old girl, and she presented, the first concerns for her were with failure to thrive, poor growth as a baby. Her early motor milestones were normal. So she sat up at 5 months, she crawled at 8 months, she was pulling up and cruising at 11 months. But her parents felt that her development seemed to slow after her first birthday. Her first specialist evaluation at our institute at Kennedy Krieger was actually in our autism center when she was 20 months old, and she met criteria for autism. At that time, her neurologic exam was totally normal. We saw her back, she came back several times in our autism center. She, over the course of the next few months and few years, she had gradual motor deterioration. She was stable until about age 2.5, but then things seemed to go downhill. She became dystonic and stiff. She had epistatonic posturing. She developed swallowing difficulties. She had staring spells that were determined to be seizures. She was first evaluated in the general genetics clinic at age 2, and at that time, a SNP array and Fragile X were normal. When we saw her in neurogenetics at age 3, at that time, she was clearly showing this abnormal neurologic exam, so we conducted a more extensive workup. Her first brain MRI at age 1 year 10 months, shown here, was normal. However, a follow-up MRI at 3 years 2 months was subtly abnormal, showing a subtle hyperintensity in the globus pallidus, which is the deep brain, the deep part of our brain. Her workup was extensive, SNP array, Fragile X, metabolic screening, you name it. She had a lumbar puncture for CSF neurotransmitters that was normal. During one of her surgical procedures when she was getting a G-tube placed, she had a muscle biopsy, and this showed on the EM, it showed abnormal mitochondria. You can see here that those do not look like happy mitochondria. So on the basis of that and her regression, she was started on a mitochondrial cocktail. Exome sequencing was ordered at age 3.5, and when we got the results about 6 months later, we were quite surprised. So this young lady was found to have a homozygous known mutation in the PANK2 gene, which is associated with pantothenate kinase-associated neurodegeneration, or PKAN. And as the name suggests, this is not a very good disorder. Her presentation, or classically it starts in childhood, with delays and progressive motor problems and dystonia, and unfortunately this is a fatal disease. So what was surprising about this diagnosis, though, is that if you look in the literature, all individuals with PCAN are said to have the eye of the tiger sign on the brain MRI, which is due to iron deposition in the basal ganglia. So this is shown here on the left. This is actually from the gene review on PCAN. Now, on the right, I'm showing you again our patient's MRI at age 3 or 2 months when she was far into the disease, and it does not show the eye of the tiger. So what were the management implications? A big implication here is on prognosis. This is a fatal degenerative disease, and we didn't expect this at the time she initially presented at age 1.5. She looked just like a child with developmental delay and autism, so nobody would have guessed that this is how it was going to end up. This is a devastating diagnosis, and it is incurable, but it allowed us to provide the family with anticipatory guidance and end-of-life planning. So after evaluations and consultations, the parents decided to not take extreme measures, and they went the route of hospice care, of comfort care. Unfortunately, she passed away earlier this year at the age of 5, but it was an outcome that the family was able to prepare for. So other implications other than prognosis is that once we got the diagnosis, we discontinued her vitamin cocktail and CoQ, which had been started presuming this might be mitochondrial. This is a diagnosis that there was a clinical trial going on for, a medication called deferiprone, which is a chelation drug to remove the iron. She would have been eligible, but the parents decided not to pursue that. And then lastly, the other big implication here is for reproductive planning. Her parents want more children. On the basis of this, we know that it's a recessive disease with a 25% recurrence risk, and so her parents are planning to pursue either prenatal testing or PGD. So in conclusion, what we have learned from our experience using this test at Kennedy-Krieger is that exome sequencing has a high diagnostic yield. It's especially useful for patients with nonspecific presentations, such as developmental delay or cerebral palsy, and also for atypical presentation. It allows us to make diagnoses earlier in the course of the disease. So for the last case that I just told you about, the little girl with PCAN, so the time from the initial evaluation to diagnosis was 2 years and 4 months, and that's for a child who was only 4 years old, so over half her life. We've shown that the results frequently impact patient management, and also this illustrates the benefits of a genotype-first approach. And this is leading to a paradigm shift, I think, in the field of genetics. So with that, I'd like to acknowledge my co-authors and the fabulous people I work with at Kennedy-Krieger. I'd like to acknowledge the clinical laboratories for performing the testing and, of course, our patients and families. Shown here are the two brothers who were the first patients to undergo exome sequencing at our institute. And with that, I will pass it over to our next presenter, Dr. Iglesias.
Thank you, Julie. That was a wonderful introduction and detailed follow-up with what happened with your own patients, and welcome everybody again. So what I'm going to be doing now is sort of following this trail. The data we got was a little more crowded because we actually didn't look at a particular cohort. We look at patients with different presentations. So I'm going to be selecting some of the findings and going to be reviewing some of the good results for this and some of the big challenges that we have in terms of what is coming. So basically, this is what we did, and we just, you know, published last June. And the experience basically in all the patients that we follow here at Columbia. So this is basically the reference. Eventually, if you go back to the reference itself. And as a background that clearly is going to overlap with most of the things that Julie was discussing, is the fact that when we decided to start looking at this, whole exome sequencing was already used basically in research settings, but not clearly in clinical settings. One of the things that we were considering a possibility when we were planning to look at the data, and this is basically the same thing that Julie was just saying, is that using a mean that is fast and pretty accurate can help and impact in basically all the gamuts that the patient can present. One big issue that is here is this clear, long, and sometimes painful, in all means, diagnostic odysseys that these families as patients get involved. And of course, the health providers are involved with them. The other thing that it's also quite interesting now is that this can be used in the postmortem setting, because we know that, you know, sampling is very limited, and this can be a very powerful means to make a diagnosis. The other issue is that the yield, if we look at the overall yield of the test in comparison with single tests, unless, of course, the phenotype is very well defined, it seems to be much, much higher. Of course, you know, as Julie was saying, having the diagnosis make a huge impact in management, prognosis, recurrent risk, and family planning. And this is another thing why Wes is very appealing. Considering all this, we basically decide to look back at our data, and we'll look first at the first 115 patients that we evaluated here at Columbia. This basically was done in a two-year period, and we look back at the charts of all these patients that had been evaluated here. The main point was to try to address practical issues, and at the end I'm going to show you some data from other places that, although at the end is pretty consistent with the yield that we are getting, it was not initially focused on the practicality of this. It was more like a proof that the thing works and how the results are useful or not. So basically, our hypothesis was that clearly using WES was a means to improve our diagnostic ability and yield, and definitely to address all the practical issues that are involved with making a genetic diagnosis. So as I said, we reviewed these 115 patients. This was done by three board-certified clinical geneticists here. Each of us, that are part of, you know, the authors on the paper, evaluate personally these patients, and we get the assistance or six genetic counselors that were involved also in the cases. This was this two-year period. WES was done for all of them. Since we were doing this somehow in a research basis, we got, you know, REB approval. And one important thing that was that this assessment was done before the recommendation for incidental findings was released back in March 2013 by the ACMG. Therefore, we didn't deal with all these additional results. Although nowadays, this has changed a little bit because the original recommendation was to either offer this to the patients, and if they decline it, not to do the test, of course. This was very controversial, so nowadays families and patients and parents can opt out of this. And we can touch this later again. So the main thing, as Julie was describing for her own patients, was the fact that all the patients have some sort of phenotype that was highly suggestive to be genetic. Although you might wonder, you know, what is that? But clearly, you know, over the years, experienced geneticists can put things together, and you get to a point where it's a very strong suspicion that the basis of the disease can be genetic. In any case, the decision about ordering WES was based in that clinical assessment. This basically means, and this is very important in terms of how this is implemented, it's not that every patient that walks into our clinics gets WES automatically. The judgment about how difficult or not the diagnosis might be, the alternative to the diagnosis are extremely important, because otherwise people can, you know, start claiming, okay, well, even if I don't know anything about genetics, if I don't know what it is, I order WES. And that's not the case. And it's very important to remember that, because at the end I'm going to talk about the problems with WES, the caveat with WES. So it's not the magic pill, and we need to be very aware about that. Clearly, everybody gets counseling, and in the same way that Julie was describing, we use basically all these labs listed here, and we use also our own lab that was on board. So this was a matter of historically being available. So Ambry was the first lab, started with this, and get Baylor and GeneDx afterwards, and our labs start doing this. Basically, the decision was heavily, heavily related with insurance coverage. And this is a thing that Julie was mentioning, and I'm going to touch about how we actually get into that coverage, because in the real world, it's an extremely important point. So when we look at the data, clearly all these things that you can see here were abstracted from the charts. So the whole demographics of the patients, the indication that we're going to show you a table with that, the clinical features, family history, the insurance, as I said, previous laboratory results, and as the same way that, you know, was described before, some of these patients have a lot of things done previously that were all inconclusive or negative. And eventually, the other thing that was extremely important were these two last things. How the clinician actually make an interpretation out of the results and how that information was used for the patient. The way we basically characterize this patient, and this is, of course, you know, artificial in some way, was to make different categories that, from the phenotypic point of view, were, as far as our clinical judgment, the most important ones. And this is something that in genetics matters a lot, although I would say applies for medicine in general. But clearly, in genetics, it's extremely important to try to identify from the phenotype the things that might be unique to a genetic syndrome. In other words, if a patient has developmental delay, intellectual disability, even autism, well, clearly the etiology for that could be genetic, but could be environmental, could be a combination of those things. And usually it's very difficult to differentiate one case from the other. So when we start piling things that are slightly very, very rare, and the patient starts showing a lot of these things individually, well, the likelihood for this to be just a random issue, it's extremely less likely. And basically, historically, what is quite interesting also, a lot of the diagnoses that we made in the past were based on this criteria that use major and minor criteria for, you can name Marfan or NF1, tuberous sclerosis, fragile X, even in the past when we didn't have anything else to use. So the whole idea was to identify things that individually were very common, but together were extremely rare. So that's basically how these categories came from. Moreover, when more of one of these features that was important was present, and this is kind of a little tricky thing, try to figure out which one was giving more impact in the patient. So here, clearly, you have a big overlapping. So in this table, it's basically a summary of all the things I was mentioning. On the left, you can see basically all the demographics. And if you can see, basically, pediatrics was heavily represented here. Gender was kind of equal. Ethnicity, basically most of the patients were Caucasian. Consanguinity present here, and this usually it's a big, big red flag that we look at autosomal recessive disorders. Family history also very important. And as Julie mentioned, most of the patients tested were part of a trio. So we got the parents and we got the patient, and this is extremely useful for the lab to start filtering the results. When this is not available, well, we try different combinations here. Where this happened? Well, for us, most of the patients were in the outpatient clinic, but we have some of them, up to 25%, in the inpatient. And here is the big thing about the insurance I described before. About 75% of them have a private insurance. And you mentioned that this is an expensive test. Currently, this runs probably between $5,000 and $7,000. So different labs charge slightly different, but still this is, you know, the ballpark. Of course, coverage coming from insurance company varies, so each lab can make individual deals with each insurance company. But of course, you know, the big bottleneck for us is this. Medicaid patients, even Medicaid HMOs, and Medicare is probably impossible these days. So, and depending where you are practicing, the Medicaid population can be large. So this is a very, very important thing. So from a practical point of view, the lab won't get much from Medicaid. It's more related with, well, how much Medicaid budget the hospital has and how much money is allocated for that. So the other practical thing is that we were able to use Medicaid usually for inpatients because the billing is much easier because it goes with the inpatient bill. But as outpatient, it's very difficult. Eventually, our own lab, using their own budget, was able to cover most of the Medicaid patients. If you look on the right, you see basically the categories that I was describing before. And clearly, in the same fashion that Julie was describing, developmental delays, intellectual disabilities, high on the list, as well as birth defects, also 25, they take clearly 50% of our phenotypes. And sometimes they are, of course, combined. Here again, developmental delay, intellectual disability by themselves is not probably a heavily phenotype that you can assume is purely genetic. And on the other hand, birth defects usually tend to be genetic. So this is one way to sort out. If you can see the rest, well, it goes down. Here, seizure is another very common reason. And lately, and Julie just described that, we have been very successful diagnosing patients with seizures, developmental delay, or some sort of chronic encephalopathic patterns. So this is an area that is exploding these days. So if we keep moving with this, as I said, basically each geneticist look at the results. And this goes back to also how she was describing how the analysis is done. When we get the report, basically the lab itself is the one that makes the initial judgment. And they use, of course, all the tools that Julie was describing. The literature review is extremely, extremely important these days because, as she say, and we basically have our own experience for two cases in this study, that when we did the test, was no actual evidence that the gene found was causing the disease. And about 2 weeks, 3 weeks later, we found reports in the literature. So we went back to the data, reviewed the data, and confirmed the diagnosis. And usually the labs this day do, I would say, biannual or annual reviews of the data just to update what they have, and eventually they generate, you know, amended reports. Here at Columbia, what we do is once a week, we have a meeting with our West team from the lab, and we go over the cases. So we get their input, they get our input, and eventually, you know, the report is made, putting both things together. This is kind of the same thing. And basically, as I said before, the main stage for us to start with the diagnosis, but of course, moving into management, reproductive planning, and as I would say, side effect of this is to identify caries in the family, what is not new because every time you make a clinical diagnosis that has a genetic basis and has implication for the family, this is also part of the game. So here again, you know, this is kind of the same thing that you saw in the table before, so I won't go over this again. And here is what about the yield. So, and this is very important because Julie was saying that in general, what is these days probably the number that everybody's using, the yield seems to be around 25 to 30% for basically undiagnosed patients who have, in theory, a genetic disorder to start with. Of course, if the phenotype is better defined, clearly the yield goes up. So here you can say in our cohort for developmental intellectual disability, we got almost 35%. And here it's something that also matters because the more defined and precise the phenotype, the better the yield. And this is clearly a very important thing because it means that, as I said before, before ordering West, we have to think about the patient. And we have to make a big effort to be sure that we are characterizing the phenotype the best way we could. With that, the yield is going to go up. If we play this the other way around, the yield is going to start going down, and we're going to start wasting a lot of money with this. Looking at the distribution of the cases in terms of type of inheritance, this is not a surprise because this historically, we know that autosomal dominant disorders are more common, followed by autosomal recessive, and in our case, we have two X-linked disorders. The other thing that is also consistent with historical data is that de novo mutations are very common, in this case, about 40%. As Julie mentioned, we've identified one patient with gonadal mosaicism, what has very heavily implication for counseling and reproductive planning. And this is another thing that is quite interesting and has been seen recurrently in the last few years. Some of our patients have been found, in our case, two of them, to have mutations in two different genes, and therefore they have two different diagnoses. And this is something that, although has been over time suspected, when you have a patient with a very complex phenotype and you can somehow group some of the features into one phenotype, but other features don't fit. Well, here you can fit both phenotypes, and the end result is what you're seeing. So in the past, this was very difficult to address because basically it was very difficult to try to identify or isolate these two phenotypes. And this is something very important because it goes back to what Julie was mentioning about this test being unbiased. So we order the test. We clearly tell the lab the phenotype, so we are guiding them in terms of the filter interpretation, but we can get back some information that is somehow unexpected. And when we get it, we go back to the phenotype and try to match that. So we are, at the same time, learning a lot from this. So here you can see something else that was actually very interesting. And these two things are, I would say, sort of complementary. One thing is that this test allows us to find mutations in genes, and you see here these different genes, that historically in the literature has been associated with very clear cat phenotypes. So, in other words, if you look at the phenotype of the patient, and Julie was mentioning, you know, the last example with this iron accumulation that actually didn't happen, at least in the MRIs. So the question is, when you don't see the thing that traditionally has been associated with the gene, is because the gene is not causing disease, or is because what you're seeing now is a phenotype that is slightly different from the traditional phenotype? And that seems to be actually the case. So in these patients, we find mutations in genes that in this case, the first one, the ACTG2, has been associated with autosomal dominant familial visceral myopathy, where the phenotypes were slightly different. Same thing for this, that is a well-known syndrome. This nemaline myopathy, also the same thing. So what we are learning, although you can see that it's few patients out of the 115, is that in some cases, we are getting data from the West that has to be analyzed in a very stringent way, contrasted with the phenotype, but also with an open mind, because eventually what the patient might be showing is something slightly different. The other part that is probably the other side of the coin is clearly doing this, you have a chance of finding new genes that are potentially associated with new human diseases. And in this case, we find four. Of course, here, and I can show you this in the table, And this is the one about the expanding phenotype, so to speak. And it's right here. Here's the three free cases, the other two cases. So these are the diseases that are considered to be a standard if you consider associated with this. And on the last column, you see that some changes were made in terms of management, which is quite important. So for this first case, the recurrent risk was redefined to 1%. Second case was no changes. Here, the family used information from regular planning. Here, they decide to do a termination later on in another pregnancy. Here, no changes. Here, the patient was referred to a muscular dystrophy association. And here, since this is associated with mitochondrial disorders, it triggered an evaluation that was not thought before. So clearly, you know, the impact is huge. Of course, also it's arguably that, well, if you have a diagnosis by other means, you're clearly going to change the management and fine-tune the management, what is true. But the speed of the West in getting a diagnosis done is some of the things that definitely is making a big difference here. And here are the four ones that describes the new genes. And here, for example, in this particular case, although this is considered to be a new disease, well, B6 was given to the patient because the enzyme used B6 as a cofactor. So again, you know, a very clear-cut result can give you a hint in terms of how to proceed in terms of management. So one of the things that is very important before going into this and just wrapping up this discussion is this thing about the speed of the West or how fast we can get it. Traditionally, or at least nowadays, if you order this in a regular case, different labs take different time, but I would say the average is probably around 4 months, 3-4 months. And although in some cases this patient has been around for years trying to get a diagnosis, well, from the patient point of view, of the parent point of view, time still matters. So if you tell them we're going to get this in 2 weeks, it's much better than 4 months. Well, from a practical point of view, the test is actually doable that fast. And we have some examples. Here, although the data is not presented here, we have a small cohort of patients in the NICU that were studied, and we were able to get results in 2 weeks. And recently, last week, I have a case from a patient that, and this is quite interesting, this is a newborn that has an abnormal ultrasound done very late in the pregnancy with a very abnormal looking brain with something that was suspicious of calcification, was born with microcephaly, has an MRI of the brain with calcifications and abnormal migration and abnormal corpus callosum, is currently very spastic. And initially, the newborn screening, and here in New York, this is actually important, but Julie knows about this, we started at the beginning of the year testing for ALD. So, of course, the whole idea was to screen patients before symptoms develop for possible treatment. However, since the screening looks basically to very long-chain fatty acids elevation, especially C26, well, you can see a positive result in a patient that might have other disease that can cause the same thing. For example, a peroxisomal disorder associated like Zellweger or something like that. So we got a call from this. We have a very mild positive, and we repeat the very long-chain fatty acid were slightly elevated. So we asked our lab to look initially, and this is another thing that is very useful for West, to look initially at all the peroxisomal genes. So the lab processes the sample, get the data, has all the gene sequence, but start looking at a small cohort of them. When they didn't find anything, they start moving out of that. And eventually they found a mutation in a gene that causes Aicardi-Goutier syndrome. So So now we know that the patient has that condition, and going back to the phenotype again, is very consistent. So this is something that mimics a CMV infection. So you have a kid with microcephaly, calcifications, abnormal brain MRIs. So, and this took 2 weeks. So in this case, well, we alert the lab about the urgency of the thing. So in 2 weeks, and I have a meeting with this family 2 days ago, I was able to go over all the things. Unfortunately, this is a disease that has a very poor prognosis, but this family is already thinking about having another child, so reproductive information is super helpful here. So, and this is like, you know, a good example of everything that we've been talking about. So, going back to a summary of what we found, as I said, our yield was slightly higher than what we can see in more general studies, and probably because our cohort is slightly biased, because the our clinic, this is not samples coming from anywhere. It's just our own sample. Again, for a very specific phenotype, the yield goes up 50% for birth defects. This is extremely high, considering we were able to diagnose maybe 10 years ago. As I said, for some of the patients, and this is also something that Julie mentioned, early diagnosis is very important. So although these are known syndromes, well, if you made the diagnosis sooner or later, you can do interventions, you can start planning. It's a big, big difference. The other thing is expansion of the phenotypes as mentioned. And of course, this discovery of genes. What is also important here is, as you can see in the slide, we actually got 18 reports suggesting new genes. So it means that we have to be extremely careful about reviewing the data and trying to match everything that we know about the patient with the results. So clearly, out of the 18, eventually we thought that only 4 have actual meaning in terms of diagnosis. So here, just a comparison, and I pick randomly, you know, Baylor, because basically two reasons. One is the numbers. They clearly are probably the largest lab in the country getting samples. And here was published like 6 months before our paper. And here you can see that they got about 29% yield out of 250 problems. So recently, like 2 months ago, they followed this data. And now they have 2,000. And actually, probably they have 3,000, but they reviewed 2,000. And here the yield is 25%. So clearly, you know, the larger the sample and the less unbiased, the yield goes slightly down. But this is very, very consistent what Julie was saying. And I would say this is what we are everybody now considering to be the yield of this. So in conclusion, clearly our results, along with this other report from other people, are confirming that West is extremely useful to make diagnosis of things that are very difficult to diagnose, incomplete phenotypes because they are different or the patient is too young. Eventually, as a corollary of that, to be able to expand the phenotype and down the line to find new genes. The insurance coverage, at least in our case, was highly successful. Although it's very difficult to get data, and we are working on that to see, okay, when we get rejected and when we actually not get rejected, so we can get better numbers. Clearly, our diagnostic yield went up. This is no doubt. And clearly, all the things that we were talking about the impact. Basically, we can anticipate problems. We can intervene early. We can avoid doing invasive testing. If you do testing like Julie was mentioned, the other one I was mentioned about, you know, the Pol-G. You find the patient has a mitochondrial disorder, well, probably you need to do a muscle biopsy. And this is extremely important in some cases. Clearly, you can fine-tune risk recurrence, talk about carriers, and eventually, you know, reproductive planning is extremely important. Here, at least when we published this data, we thought that probably 30% was accurate. I would say probably now 25 to 30, but still and this goes basically, you know, to the end of the talk, is related with where we're going with this and how good or better West can get. Well, clearly, the sequencing efficiency and the yield that clearly are far of the scope of this, but it's a technical thing that is getting much, much better. The other thing is what Julie was mentioning. There are problematic areas in the genome that are not very well covered by West. So this is another thing. Clearly, the software improvement is another avenue. And the other thing that lately all the labs are trying to do is to share all their information from the database. Cost reduction is a very important thing, and we know that, you know, our magic goal is $1,000 genome. We'll eventually get there. The turnaround time is extremely important. And this is a bottleneck related with interpretation. So doing the test doesn't take too long, but somebody has to sit in front of the computer and sort this out. So we need a lot of people for this. The other thing is to try to optimize how panels work and how West. Panels for a lot of things. Seizures, autism, cardiomyopathies, arrhythmias. Well, in some cases, we can try this, and eventually, as this iCard Gutierrez case I described to you guys is negative, well, we can jump into this. The data is there. The raw data is in the computer. We got it already and can be used. And of course, at the end, and this goes back to, well, thinking first and eventually do things later, is to try to optimize the flow of all these things. Sometimes a microarray is enough. Sometimes a panel is enough. Sometimes not, so West, and eventually whole genome sequencing is our next step. So I guess this is the last slide, and as Julie said, definitely appreciate, you know, the effort of everybody who was involved in this and all the people working here, my colleagues, including geneticists and genetic counselors, and definitely all our patients that were so helpful to help us with this.
Great. Thank you so much for your time today, and also thank you very much for attending this webinar. And Dr. Iglesias and Julie, thank you so much for your time. This has been very informative. Have a wonderful afternoon, and stay safe, and happy holidays to everybody.
Well, thank you, everybody, and it has been a pleasure just doing this.
Thank you very much, everyone.
This has been an Ambry Genetics production of Next and Now. To learn more, visit ambrygen.com.